everyone here in person. Linda is joining us via Zoom. Nice to have Linda here. She doesn't hear, maybe, but we'll ask Regent West to do the roll call, please.
Okay, thank you, Chair Bell.
Present.
Regent Hall. Regent Brinkley.
Present.
Regent Henson.
Present.
Regent McKinney.
Present.
Vice Chair Milken.
Here.
Regent Nichols.
Here.
Regent Spiller.
Present.
Regent Thomas.
Present.
Secretary West here. And Regent Winninger.
Present.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we have 11 regents present, representing the four on the board.
That is a full house. Glad to have everyone here. Next item on the agenda is approval of our minutes from the third quarterly meeting, which was held on August 6th this year. Okay, we will add access to those minutes. And I will entertain a motion for approval.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second for approval of minutes from our August 6th meeting. Any discussion? Corrections? Deletions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Minutes stand approved. We will swing into the Academic Affairs Committee.
Good morning. I am asking for approval of emeritus appointments. As a reminder, 57 faculty receive recommendations to get emeritus status. Usually we would need three or four lines for each one, but that would be a long time, so we will pass on that today. 37 of them were in the BSIP program, and there's one correction that we mentioned last time, which was that Dr. Schneider is full professor. With that, looking for a motion to approve.
Regent West, any comments to your committee?
No, we approved this at our committee meeting, and it's a very distinguished list, and I just want to say I think I speak on behalf of the board congratulating each one on this list, and I'm asking for a motion for approval of emeritus status for the recommended individual.
Have so moved.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion or comments? If not, all those in favor of approval of the Emerita appointments as presented, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Provost.
And Provost Fisher, I think we have another presentation from you, some exciting things going on with some informational items that Provost Fisher wanted to discuss with the board.
So we started the fall semester by doing what we call a DDD workday, and that was putting the deans, department chairs, and directors in a room and talking about topics that we thought were important for moving the university forward. Things such as student success, research, and creative activities, as well as communication. And what we got and how we did that is breakout sessions, and when we did that, lots of cool ideas bubbled to the top, and we are now in the process of working our way through all of the notes. And in doing that, have come up with a few things that we think we can start come January to start moving and taking those and moving them out to the institution. So the first one is the Provost Innovation Teaching Grant. That will go out. So if you look at what we have tons of grants for research and creative activities, but really nothing for people who are interested in teaching. In this case, what we want to do is really, because it's where we come from, a normal college, is to put an opportunity for people who have different types of pedagogical ideas into play to see if that improves teaching or not. And that's how we're going to do it. And it's going to be based on four kind of focal areas. Fostering career competencies. We're interested in online and hybrid learning. We're also interested in high-impact practices and diversity, equity, and inclusion. In addition to that, what we're looking for are opportunities that will use a number of faculty together to really service a large population of students. In addition to that, the population of students we would love for it to service is the underrepresented groups on this campus. So we have put this together, and what we have is about $50,000 worth of grant money to give out to faculty. The call will go out in the spring, and how we will determine how much they get for the project is how many students are affected and how many faculty work in that project. And from there, there's three expectations of them. One is that they will incorporate the new pedagogical opportunities. Two is that they will do some type of assessment that they can see whether it's working or not. And three is they have to disseminate it to the campus. So there will be an opportunity for other people to see what they're doing and see if that can fit into their areas. And eligible comes back to tenure track, as well as instructors, full-time people on this campus, full-time faculty on this campus. In addition, one near and dear to my heart is our new first-gen faculty and staff initiative. Now, this isn't new. Martha started it, got it going. Other places, the colleges did too. And what we decided to do was jump on board and kind of be the center area. And what we're really trying to do is tell our first-gen students that we want to welcome to WKU and that they can be successful. And what are we really trying to do is create a welcoming, belonging community so that when they walk on campus, there's somebody to help them understand how to work their way through what would be, in some cases, that transition from high school to college, which can be really difficult for a first-gen student. In addition, so how do we do it? We identify faculty who are first-gen or people who are interested in supporting. And I will tell you, we put a call out twice in the last month, and we got 150 people to sign up. So we now have 150 people. When we started, we figured 20 would be great, and we have 150, so we're doing great. In addition, then what we're going to do is we're going to build a support network for the first-gen students. And how do you do that is really the question, right? And what we're going to do is a few things, and then I'll continue on after that. First of all, they need to know who are the first-gen people and who are the supporters. And what you see over there, that WKU First Gen, is a sticker that's right now being made that will be sent to everybody who wanted to be a part of this program to put on their door, to put on their car, and we have stuff for their emails. So they can be identified quickly by the students. In addition, what we want to do is create a list of first-gen faculty and supporters and staff who want to be a part of this process so that the students know who are interested in talking to them. Who are the people that you can go to if you have a question and you're a first-gen and you really don't know anybody on this campus? And that's really important. In addition, we have created videos that we will send the students here soon that talk about experiences that the faculty had and staff had that were first-gen and how they figured out how to find their way through campus and be successful. In addition, we are doing another set that will be done by first-gen faculty and staff that will give students who are incoming freshmen ideas about how to be successful and what they should do early on. And lastly, we have right now a calendar of events that includes socials, panel discussions, symposiums, and other college events to be able for students to be participating with faculty so that we create that community that I think first-gen students need to be able to be successful. And it doesn't stop there, because what we've had is kind of a groundswell. The deans were way ahead of me on this also, as well as Martha, and all the colleges have taken it up, and they are now running some type of first-gen in their colleges, which is great, which means only more opportunities for the students to get together with faculty. And we've had tons of inquiries from alumni and the community who want to know how they can get involved, and we're working on that right now to bring them into the system. This is, for me, incredibly important, and the reason I say that is I was that first-gen kid. I didn't even know where the university was until I showed up that day. And I had never seen the university, and I had never seen my dorm room. And I showed up and met some student that was my roommate, and it went on from there. But the transition was a tough one, and what we're really trying to do is make this a smooth transition. And I wanted you to know what we were doing. Thank you.
Comments? Any
questions? Comment?
Great program.
Thanks. Martha, you got anything to say about that?
Good stuff.
I would just add, strong supporter, the communication gap between with the students, what they don't know this year, and I've already communicated with the provost about this, we've lost some of our culture during the crisis that we've gone through. The number of students who come to me and said, what do you mean there's a final exam scheduled? And these are sophomores, and I've had to pull up the exam schedule and say, yes, the university has this, and they don't know it exists. And this is not just first gen, it's across the board. We've lost so much of the atmosphere and culture of the university, and we don't even know what we've lost. We never know what those gaps are on the language and communication until they actually come to us and ask those questions. So the work is really cut out for us, much more than what it was before the pandemic. That has been a lesson I've learned very, very hard to make.
Also, I commend the provost for talking to Martha and then having Martha convince him that he should do something. I know how Martha does that. But being close to the program of what Martha's been doing, it's fascinating, and I'm so glad to see the university expanding it more. Because I tell everybody, which I try not to tell the secret sauce we have, but it's always nice to go across the country and tell people how exciting of stuff we're doing and the impact that it's actually really having. So I'm thrilled to see it go across the university.
I would encourage any region, if you're on campus sometime, drop into Martha's office, as I did one day, and was able to interact with some students and see what Martha's doing. And like that experience, and certainly highlights the importance of the work that we're all trying to do for student success. Very good.
I think that concludes the business of the academic fair.
Okay. Thank you for that great presentation, Mr. Provost. Next item concerns our Finance and Budget Committee. Richard Kenny.
Okay. Action items FB1 through FB4 were presented and approved at the committee meeting. Would anybody like to remove any of these items for individual consideration or discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'd entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All right, does anybody have anything to discuss or
these items?
All right. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like sign.
There's no abstention.
All right. That takes care of FB1 through FB4. Now the items that were not presented. FB5 is the first one, acceptance of the auditor's report of financial statements for June 30, 2021.
So, Jeff, can you pull up the... Okay, I just want to say a couple of words about the financial statements before I turn it over to our auditor from Crow. So, next slide. And then the next slide. So the good news about the audit is that with an unqualified opinion, a clean audit, that's the best opinion you can get from a financial audit. The really good news on the financial side is our cash equivalents increased by $20 million and our net position increased by $66 million. Both of these are really good indicators of the solid financial health of the university. And as I said, I think at our last meeting, our cash position is continuing to increase pretty much over the last 3 years. So that's really the only comments I have. This is really an opportunity for our auditors to present their findings to the board. So I will turn it over to Brad Sheely. He's the managing director with Crook.
Sure. Thank you all. Pull down the mask just so you can hear me a little bit.
Do you have the presentation, our presentation here? There we go.
It's a presentation device if you want to write it.
All right. So, again, just thank you all for allowing me to present today and go through a few highlights with you all. Again, my name is Brad Shelley. I'm a partner at Crow, and glad to be working with you all. And this year, obviously, was a challenging year. I think probably across all spectrum of the university, a challenging year just from an operational standpoint, obviously. But that also extended to the financial side and the operations as far as the audit goes, the audit preparation. A lot of new federal dollars, which is great, but with that comes a lot of restrictions and additional testing that's required. So we'll talk through a little bit about that, but I want to start off with just a high-level overview of the audit process. And really, as you'll see here, everything revolves around compliance, right? So that's the whole purpose of the audit, is to provide compliance and review of the financial statements themselves, but also, as I mentioned, the federal grants that you received and spent during the year, as well as a few different areas that we'll touch on. With that, there's kind of a high-level approach that we take. Obviously, we look at the financial statements and the compliance, as I mentioned. We look at all levels of internal control, all the way up from Board of Regents and your role as board, down through management and through all the different accounting types of controls. We, through that process, assess risk, and that may vary year to year. So we do have a similar approach year to year from a high level, but we do adjust that based on risks that are identified. And again, one of the biggest things this year was the federal grants. And so we did spend a good portion amount of time on that this year, as well as a few other areas. The one new accounting standard that is listed here is GASB 84, fiduciary activities. We did spend a good amount of time with the accounting and finance team on that to make sure that all the activities are accounted for appropriately there. Really what this was looking at was to determine if there was any kind of funds where you were holding funds as a fiduciary. And so while there was a few changes there, nothing really too significant to point out. As far as the actual deliverables and different reports that we provide, this is similar to previous years. So I know many of you have been on the board for several years. This is a consistent list. The actual audit report, the single audit, which is your federal uniform guidance report, government auditing standards report, which goes along with that. So even though you're not really a governmental agency, you do report under government auditing standards. The required auditor communication, which is referred to as the SAS 114 letter, the House Bill 622 letter, and the Kentucky Lease Law Compliance Report. So those have all been completed, and we've issued those reports. The last two items here are in process, the audit reports for the TV and radio station, and then the NCAA agreed upon procedures. And so we'll have reports probably at the next meeting for those. Again, this is a high-level overview of the audit approach and the plan, and I know you probably can't read the top section there, but at a high level, the process we go through, we spend a good amount of time frame. During that time is when we're assessing risk, going through control processes, and we begin our testing of the federal grants. That continues in mid-August to mid-September during our year-end field work, and that's where we really get into the substantive testing procedures and really testing the compliance over the federal expenditures. And then reporting really picks up from there as either the review of financial statements or the preparation of the reports. Again, just as a reminder, the financial statements do include, obviously, university, but they also include the other component units listed here, the Research Foundation, which I know doesn't currently have any activity, but is still technically part of the financial statements. And then the three other foundations, WKU Foundation, Student Life Foundation, College Heights Foundation, are all included as well as discreetly presented component units, which really just means they're in there separately. Those are audited by other firms, but they are presented in there. As far as some high-level financial information, this is just a three-year picture, snapshot of the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position or your income statement. I always find looking at 2 to 3 years gives you a little bit better overview and you can compare. Now, obviously, with the changes that have happened with the pandemic, it's not quite as comparable, but what you can see is probably what you'd expect. The operating revenues, which is where all of your tuition and fees revenue is at, that is down. But accordingly with that, your expenses have been reduced as well. You have an operating loss of about $91 million. But then where you pick up a lot of that, either additional cost that was taken on because of COVID, or picking up some of those, some additional relief that was received through federal funds, that's all in that net non-operating revenues and expenses of $157.9 million. So you see an uptick of about $20 million there. And so overall, you end up with a gain or loss. And this, you had a gain, and you had no capital contribution. So your change in net position was almost $67 million compared to the prior year, 58, and the year before, $47 million. So positive changes there. The one thing I always point out, and I do this, we work with a number of different colleges and universities in Kentucky, and in particular in Kentucky, this is something to be aware of across the country, but in particular in Kentucky with the pension and OPEB plans, and in particular KTRS, there were some changes in assumptions a couple of years ago that created a decrease in the net pension liability, but also created some larger deferred inflows, which are then getting recognized over the years. Those get recognized as a positive each year. So this year you had a pension and OPEB income, I'll call it, of $61 million. It's not a cash inflow, it's purely a accounting books type of entry. But I point that out just to make you aware of you did have a positive $67 million, but about $61 million of that is this positive amortization of the pension and OPEB. So, again, two things to point out there. One, that's a big chunk of that. On the positive side, you still had about $6, $7 million when you take that piece of it out of it. And I think the other thing that goes along with that, and I know I've mentioned this in previous meetings, one is with those pension and OPEB plans, you really have no control over those outside of whether you participate in them. You have no control over the assumptions that go into that, into the discount rate that goes into that, the investment returns, all of that obviously is no control. So while you're receiving some positive benefits now, that could fluctuate either way. It could be additional positive down the road or negative. Just always something to keep in mind. From a statement of net position standpoint, or balance sheet, again, just a high-level view here, what you'll see is a few different things. One, your assets and deferred outflows are pretty consistent over the 3 years, which is obviously a good thing, especially dealing with a global pandemic. To see an actual increase in assets and deferred outflows is positive. You're seeing the liabilities and deferred inflows decrease. Again, a good chunk of that is related to the pension and OPEB plans, but nonetheless, that's always positive to see those numbers going down. And then kind of a landmark this year was your net pension, which has been negative ever since the new GASBs came on board, GASB 68 and 75, which required the recording of the net pension and OPEB liabilities. Before that, I think you were positive. That took you into a negative and took most entities into the negative. in that position. This year, you actually moved back up into the positive. So another positive financial indicator there. From a federal grant compliance standpoint, as I mentioned, this year obviously was challenging with all the additional funding that was received. And in particular, challenging because there was a good amount of funding that was provided, which was always welcome. But some of the guidance around how that can be utilized wasn't very specific, provided by the, when I say guidance provided by the federal granting agencies. There were a good amount of restrictions provided on those funds by the DOE, but they were pretty broad restrictions. And so obviously when you get down in the details, there can be a lot of gray area, and working through a lot of that gray area and what is allowed and what's not allowed was a challenge, I know, for management and then for auditors as well. So the four major programs that were tested this year, student financial aid, which we test every year, the Education Stabilization Fund, which is the CARES fund or the HERF funding that you're probably familiar with, Coronavirus Relief Fund, and the Head Start cluster. So those were all required to be tested this year. We did testing over those. From the positive standpoint, no material weaknesses or compliance findings through that testing. We did have one significant deficiency in internal control that we identified, and that was around some funding that was received late in the process and was essentially double counted, was claimed on two different grants. We identified one of those expenditures when we were testing. As management looked into that further, they identified a little bit more that was claimed twice. They worked with the granting agency, and so you won't end up losing any of that money. You had to, they basically said, hold that those funds and you can claim that on future expenditures. So didn't impact anything there, didn't have any result of loss of cash or anything like that, but was something you identified in the process. And again, I would say just as a general comment, in working with a number of different colleges and universities, there was certainly an uptick in the number of findings that we had this year, again, just because of the number of federal dollars that were flowing through. So, as far as other required communications, just a number of things here. Again, we do provide a letter that outlines all of this. This is a summary of that. It goes through our responsibility as auditors, which is to provide an opinion on the financial statements. The financial statements themselves are management's responsibility. We do communicate our independence from the university, so we do audits for a number of different agencies that are related to the university, and we outlined all the different deliverables we have, but we are independent from that standpoint, which is obviously important both for us and for you. If there were any significant accounting policies, those are all noted in one of the financial statements, and then if any significant auditor's judgments throughout the process, we would notify you of those, and we did not have anything here to mention. As I mentioned earlier, we did have the one significant deficiency that came about because of this one posted audit adjustment that we had, and really the key thing here was recognizing revenue as came about because of some double counting of expenditures, but the actual accounting result of that was shifting from revenue to deferred revenue. No waived adjustments, so those would be audit adjustments that we identified that management chose to waive, so a positive there. And then just other communications, again, no significant difficulties or disagreements with management, no other consultations with other accountants, so no real concerns that standpoint. And then the last slide here is, I always like to kind of look forward and give a brief overview of what's coming down the road. And so as I mentioned, this past year we had GASB 84, which took a little bit more time. GASB 87 is the next one that's on the horizon for next year, and it revolves around leases, and it'll be a little bit more challenging. There'll be more work for the finance and accounting team for sure, because what this requires is for them to gather all of the leases and all of the contracts that may appear to be a lease or may have a lease component in there, evaluate all those, determine if GASB 87 is applicable and they actually are a lease, and then how they'll have to determine how to record those transactions. The end result at a very high level is pretty much any type of operating lease that you have, which is currently accounted for just as an expense. You're essentially just expensing it as you use that service, or you, in the case of if you are leasing something out, providing that service, you're recording that revenue or expense as it happens. Under GASB 87, what you'll essentially do is treat it like a capital lease, where you would have an asset and a liability. There's some deferred inflows and outflows as well, but essentially what you'll have is an asset liability type of relationship. Don't expect there to be a significant net impact from that, but you will have a significant amount of assets and liabilities that'll come on the books related to this. And we've already had some initial discussions with management about this, and I know they're working on this and looking into it. The next two are a little less impactful. GASB 89 just talks about the accounting for interest that's incurred before place into service. So if you ever have a construction process and you have financing from that, the accounting for that will change on any interest that's incurred. And then the last one is actually 2 years out, but GASB 96 touches on subscription-based technology agreements. So this would be, mostly around, again, technology. So it could be cloud arrangements. That's the most common one. But looking at a lot of different areas in technology and any places that you might have a subscription-based agreement that doesn't fall under GASB 87, this will have accounting impacts on those types of agreements. That covers my presentation. So again, appreciate finance and accounting's hard work and effort this year to help us through the process, to provide us all the information so that we can do the testing. Appreciate you all, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer those.
Anybody have any questions or comments? Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, and to your team for all the hard work. I think it's an excellent result. So, thank you, guys. All right. Nobody has anything further on this one. I'll entertain a motion to approve FB5.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you, Lord. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed like sign. All right. FB5 approved. All right. Now, our final item on the agenda is FB6, approval of the revisions to the 2021-22 operating budget.
So actually, there's one revision that I'm going to present to the current year budget, and it's the carry forward items. So basically, we're just asking for your approval to allocate the year-end carry forward from the fiscal year 21 carry forward back out to the units where the carry forward existed. And this carry forward adjustment is based on the new policy that was approved in January of 2021. And let me remind the board that the policy exempts categories, and they receive 100% of their carry forward. And these categories are revenue dependent indexes, auxiliary units, course and program fees, direct state appropriations. An example of that would be the Gatton Academy, doctoral programs, FNA, graduate research fees, and RCAP grants, and university distinguished professorship awards. Just so you understand, carry forward exists. It's not revenue, it's cash at the end of the year, and it's generated by either the units are exceeding their budgeted revenues or they're underspending their expenditure budgets. And it's prudent that we do not allow units to use this to create permanent positions. This is one-time cash, so we really do not want them to use it to create permanent ongoing positions or hire permanent personnel. We do allow, there's exceptions to every rule, that if you're in need within the unit, we request that unit to get approval. And the academic side would be through the provost on the administrative side, either myself or the president. So this is what the dollars look like. So for the exempted allocations, those are the ones that receive 100% of their carry forward back. That's around almost $24 million. The non-exempted allocations, based on the updated carry forward policy, is about $3.2 million for a total request of $27 million. So the good news is that's a significant amount of carry forward for the units to be generating each year, and that's pretty consistent to what it's been in prior years. So Jason, that's all I have, but I can take any questions.
Does anybody have any questions or comments on the carry forward? All right, hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to approve FP6.
So moved.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, like so. All right, motion passes. And that ends my agenda for the finance and budget committee. Okay, thank you very much. And I want to again thank Chairman McKinney for his hard work over the last 4 years, really chairing this committee. It's nice having a seasoned CPA in that seat. Done a great job. So we'll move on to the executive committee. We have a couple of action items, and the first one concerns an addendum to an athletic contract, and I believe we have our athletic director Todd Stewart with us today. Todd?
Yes, sir. Good morning. As we talked about before, this is consistent with how we've handled athletic contracts when a head coach goes into the final year of this contract. A coach going into a season in the last year of his contract, it's essentially a lame duck status that's used against the coach in recruiting. So this is the extension of his contract. There's no change in the base salary. And again, it's just consistent with how we've handled coaching contracts in the past.
All right. I'll entertain a motion to approve executive committee item one for head baseball.
So moved.
Second. Great.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion or comments? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those like say aye. Todd, I could ask you to comment about coaches' contracts in general. I think the Florida football coach just signed a pretty nice contract.
A lot of people are throwing Monopoly money around right now.
Yeah. I'm glad we're not talking about that kind of money. Was $52 or $3 million. Wow. Next item concerns approval of a lease at 1566 Normal Street. This was presented to us at the last meeting, and Jennifer is here.
Good morning.
To update us.
I think Jeff's going to pull up slides for us. This is an ongoing project. We've spoken. I think in the spring about this, when we had several property updates at the time. We could go to the next slide. And one more time. This is concerning the university lease of 1566 Normal Street, which is the old AO Pie property. Woo!
That's right. Everybody's seen our big pretty house.
Yeah, definitely. The property obviously very strategic location, almost across the street from us here. It's just up the road. And the real estate corporation was able to purchase this property in the last couple of months, and is what the university is doing is seeking to lease that property for $30,000 annually. And then we would use existing budgeted funds for to do that, and it would be for use by National Panhellenic Council member organizations for offices, member events, and communal gathering space. And for a further description of that, Ethan can talk to that a little bit more.
Thank you, Jennifer. This is a unique opportunity for us in the sense that our institution is among few institutions in the United States who actually host all nine of the National Panhellenic Council fraternities and sororities, our historically African-American fraternities and sororities on campus. And so to have a complement of the Divine Nine here on campus is a rich history and tradition for our institution. And in conversations I had with the president, he said that, you know, our institution hasn't had chapter rooms or chapter houses for NPHC fraternities and sororities. If we have the opportunity to perhaps help extend the engagement of those groups with property where they can host their meetings, congregation, intake processes, ritual, and overall opportunity just to have a space on campus that is dedicated to the MPHC fraternities and sororities. We thought we would take advantage of this opportunity with the Ale Pie House coming into the market and the real estate corporation acquiring that property and to use it for our students on campus. So it will be an ongoing project in development. Worked with the students and inquired about their interest. They're excited about this opportunity, but the development will be a little bit ongoing. We'll try to build some IT infrastructure and to work on the property to make it kind of a general use space. But our intent is to go forward with the opportunity of MPHC fraternities and sororities having an MPHC heritage house on campus, which they can use.
So that's the, any questions?
I'd just like to acknowledge the decision to do this. A lot of the sororities and fraternities across the country don't have access to property. It's for us to step forward as a university to do that. I think it's outstanding. It shows leadership and support of the university, the president.
Very good. Any other comments, questions? Jennifer, anything else to tell us?
And I have some updates, but I think at this point we entertain a motion.
Let's do that.
So moved.
A second. And a second to approve the lease of 1566 Normal Street as presented. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's exciting. We can move on to the next part, which is just general updates for you. Don't know if you saw the news yesterday, but we have sold 1818 Nashville Road to the Hive. And this was part of the existing lease agreement that they had. This board approved that lease 3 years ago that included an option to purchase the property at the conclusion of the lease. So they entertained that option. They were able to secure funding to take over the lease of that property, take over ownership of that property. So they now have a permanent home in Bowling Green. And if you're not familiar with the work that they do, they provide services for adults with developmental disabilities. So a wonderful program Laura Orslin has developed, and with the community support, has been able to secure the financing to develop that into a permanent location. So that was a pretty neat neat event to be a part of yesterday and really see the impact they have on the community. So that's a little positive news for WKU being a part of that. We've discussed in the past Normal Lot North expansion. This was associated with purchasing the Milliman property. And it's kind of, with all things COVID, it's been a slow process to move that project forward. And we're still waiting to raise that property. And same with the Chestnut Street, Kiss Me Quick Alley property. In both of those cases, the demolition of those properties are pending and waiting for that before we're able to move forward with those projects. But those are some of the general updates, property updates. And if you have any questions, please let me know.
Questions, comments from anyone? Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
All right. Our last item for today's meeting concerns an information item on the presidential evaluation. Perhaps not everyone knows that every year our board is charged with the responsibility of doing a presidential evaluation. I'm pleased to say that this year we had 100% participation of our board members. The evaluation is one of the most important duties that we have every year. And this year it involved an 18-page questionnaire that allows for comments and ratings of various aspects of a president's job. It included leadership ability, decision making, problem solving, concern for faculty, staff, and students, management of resources, and fiduciary duties in general, relations with the external community, physical leadership, and then last but not least, board relations. Certainly, the president's relationship with the board is one of the most critical things for success for any university. And I would hasten to point out that being president of a major university has to be one of the toughest jobs in America. That individual has to have a multiplicity of skills and challenges every day. I have prepared a one-page synopsis of this evaluation, and I won't read the whole thing, but it is being distributed to each of the regents and to the press. And one of the things that I point out here is the headwinds that are being faced by higher education today. And I think it's fair to say that higher education for a number of years has been under crisis, and those headwinds involve lots of different things, from declining student enrollment nationwide, reductions in the public support economically and otherwise, the technological innovations that are going on all the time and challenge every institution on how to afford and utilize those, the tectonic shifts that we have with social media today, which bring on a whole other set of issues and challenges. Then you have the evolvement of what we know about how people learn and what challenges that presents with how we do pedagogy, which Provost, I'm thrilled, is putting forth ideas with our faculty on how can we best change and improve pedagogy. Those are just some of them, and then you throw in a pandemic. So you can imagine how difficult the job is. Anyone paying attention the last few years would have to admit that since Dr. President Cavone's arrival, we've made many moves that, in this board's opinion, have positioned Western Kentucky University well going forward. He has a conservative approach to fiscal matters, and I think we saw evidence of the fact that we're in much better fiscal shape than we were just a few years ago, which, since one of our primary responsibilities is
fiduciaries. I find comfort in that, and I think we all should. Especially important, and I'll read this line, and I'll read the final paragraph, but especially important, President Caboni has made strides in putting together an administrative cabinet that shares his commitment to WKU's strategic plan. You all are in the room with us today, and I can't emphasize how important that is to have a team that works mutually and coherently together. Finally, and I'll read the final paragraph here, while many American colleges and universities face uncertain futures, the Western Kentucky University Board of Regents believes that under President Caboni's leadership, our university is now better positioned to harness our available resources, utilize our collective imaginations, and create an environment that fosters student success and well-being in a higher education world full of transformation. So you each have a copy of that, and this may be the longest meeting we've ever had that our president has not spoken. So or if he wishes to make any comments.
Regent Bell, thank you. When I was hired 4.5 short years ago, it was not just about becoming a president, it was about building a presidency. And while this is an evaluation of me and the work that I do, it's also an evaluation of the entire team's effort. And I'm pleased that we finally have a complete team together of deans and cabinet that are working together to advance the institution. I continue to wake up every day excited for the possibilities at Western Kentucky University. And we'll celebrate that tomorrow at commencement. Because at the end of the day, while we do all of these things, what's most important is the success, graduation, and transformation of our students. And so I appreciate the kind words, but what really matters to me is our graduation rate. And I'm proud that last year we graduated more students than ever before in the university's history. We're going to continue to do that. I have a bit of good news to share that I've quietly holding to the end of the semester. we worked and announced at my investiture 3.5 years ago this notion of a first-year village. And the question was, what could we do to transform that first-year experience for our young people? And you will recall, this is not just about buildings. This is about changing the experience that our freshmen have with pod-style living, with faculty mentorship, with advising, and with block scheduled courses. We have the numbers back 6 weeks out for our first-year students who've re-enrolled for the spring semester. And I just want to walk through some of these numbers because they're important and it demonstrates what we've accomplished so far and will continue to accomplish. So for our students who have not participated in a living learning community this fall, right now, 84% of them have re-registered for the spring semester. For those who have participated in LLC, 92% have re-enrolled for the spring semester. That's my math is accurate, that's almost an 8-point difference for those who participate. And I know there's some self-selection here, and you can critique the numbers however you want, but 8 percentage points is significant statistically, but it's also significant in the lives of those students. You disaggregate these data for underrepresented minority students, those who did not participate, 78.8%, those who did, 82.2% re-enrolling for the spring semester. For our low-income students, a tremendous jump from 80% for those who do not participate to 87% who do. And for our first-gen students, 81.3% coming back who did not participate in the LLC, 86.4% for those who have. And so this is the first indicator of what this intervention is doing for our young people. Again, not just about buildings, really about transforming that experience. And so as we continue to grow and expand living learning communities on campus, creating more opportunities for our students across all 5 of our colleges, expanding from 22 to more next year, I'm really pleased with the direction this puts us, particularly as we strive for that 80-60 goal. 80% retention in the first year with a 60% graduation rate, which will put us on par with flagship universities across the nation. So I'm thankful for the work of everyone in this room to make that happen, from construction to academics to student life to res life and everyone in between. And it's a momentous occasion for our institution, and I look forward to continuing that momentum. So thank you all.
Thank you. Comments?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I commend you on the year, and I reflect on the tremendous momentous thing today is we put to bed the budget from last year and the audit report from that, and also pivot on your evaluation in this pandemic year. And just quite frankly, I just want to look forward a little bit and just say, as someone who's been in higher education for a very long time and also a student of what's going on in the culture, I'm just frankly quite terrified and of where we're going to be in 10 or 20 years. And that's an external thing to us, but I just would, what can we do as a board and as an institution to champion the cause of higher education in our community? And it's obviously not a challenge that we're facing alone. Yet our region that we're in is probably perhaps a little stronger in anti-education than some others. And I just, you know, asking that question again and again, what can we do? And, you know, we had the comment about the bidding war that's going on in athletics, and I'm looking at what these institutions will pay for a win. They will pay millions of dollars for a win in any sport, and yet, as you said, tomorrow we go through graduation. That's our biggest win. That is our biggest win. As the students that I've seen, as they walk across that stage, and now they're going to be a tax-paying citizen of the Commonwealth who completed their education and celebrating that in some way, but just also reflecting on the fact that we've gone through tremendous changes in this institution under your leadership over the last few years. And as you said, you have your team in place. You know, finding a way to build that culture that we have of the people that are here, those survivors who are dedicated to what we're doing, and then being a champion for that, that's our challenge now. We have to fight for what we believe in. And I believe everyone in this room is a true believer in the power of higher education. So just as I look to, again, just my own terror about where we're going, what can we do on those things?
Well, we think about this every day, and not just in my office, in the region. There is a workforce group that's comprised of the superintendents in the region, mayor, county judge executive, chamber leadership, educational leadership, university, community college. Today, there are 8,000 vacant jobs in South Central Kentucky. Now, only 7% of those jobs require a bachelor's degree. So in some ways, we are meeting that need as an institution. There are jobs available. But the real challenge that we have is not just a workforce challenge, it's a pipeline challenge. I looked at our clearinghouse data that looks at individuals who have applied to Western Kentucky University and then applied to other institutions and seeing to whom we lose students. And we've been pretty flat. We lose about 200 to 250 to the University of Kentucky. Our main competitor is not the University of Kentucky. We have gone from about 180 to about 100 students that we lose to the University of Louisville each year. We lose a few hundred to our local community college. The number one loss of students from Western Kentucky University, of students who apply. Of those 10,000 students who apply or are admitted, 3,000 come here, 1,000 go someplace else. 6,000 high school students who applied at Western go nowhere for college. Our college-going rate as a region is about 30 or 40 percentage points lower than Central Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, which has an 80% college-going rate. If we want to continue to elevate our economy and attract the companies that we want to attract as we become Nashville North, we have to get more of our young people, not just considering college. And by college, I don't just mean a certificate, a two-year degree, a technical degree, or a college degree. We must do that. And one of the ways we have to do that is by not just demonstrating what we do, but how we transform the economic lives of young people who who choose post-secondary education. And so I completely agree with you. Tremendous headwinds, but our community has to do this together. And that workforce group is beginning that work. We'll have more information to share in coming months, but we're addressing it and addressing it aggressively in the region.
This is where being strategic is so important, and I don't think either one of you all are being Grinch-like in making those comments. I think, you know, it is the challenge for boards like ours to think about those things, and hopefully we can find solutions, and certainly we're all going to have to use our imaginations as we do that. So those who aren't imagining what the future is going to look like are going to wonder what ran over them. So any other comments?
This is just a feel-good comment. I learned last week that Elvin Arahamman, that's the best I can do, was named as a Rhodes Scholar. He is a 2019 graduate of the Gatton Academy. And Samuel Kessler was named as a George Mitchell Scholar. He's a 2018 graduate of the Gatton Academy. Elvin is the fourth Rhodes Scholar to have participated in the Center for Gifted Students, which I think is worthy of note.
Couldn't agree more.
Yep.
It's great. We should celebrate each student's success, and particularly ones like that really distinguish themselves. We have a number of information items in terms of our schedule for meetings next year, in the calendar year 2022, that are listed. And I believe we have a gathering tonight, which we have not been able to have in 2 years. And those gatherings are important as boards like ours work together. And Mr. President, we appreciate your hosting our board tonight for Christmas dinner.
Let me just, on this other future meeting dates, that May the 5th, the second quarterly meeting, is that actually May the 6th?
No, it's on a Thursday.
It's on a Thursday this year?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
Because Oak stays on Friday.
Thanks.
So, for those who are, that is a change in how we typically schedule our meetings. For those of you who remember commencement last year, it fell on Kentucky Derby Day.
Can't have it.
And we can't have that. And so we moved it one day back. Commencement now, unfortunately, will be on the Oaks Day. We can't afford to avoid every horse racing day in the season. But we will avoid Kentucky Derby for commencement. And so that Thursday we will have a board meeting, and then our walk down the hill and commencement will happen Thursday evening with the recognition ceremonies on that Friday.
Nice to know you're paying attention to. Any other comments? If not, stand adjourned.